All over the world today, almost 70 million people have been forcibly displaced from their homes. And every year, thousands of these people try to seek refuge in Japan.
I've never been a refugee before now, so I really don't know how it works.
Rose, a refugee from Cameroon, is one of these women.
But I just hope it works well for me.
For Rose, trying to make a home in Japan meant leaving her whole life behind just so she could be safe. But of the 10,000 people who apply for refugee status in Japan every year, only 40 get approved.
For like a week, I did not sleep. I was like, what have I gotten myself into? Maybe it was better to be there and wait for death when it comes, or whatever. I did not know what to think.
Rose's story is one of many where asylum seekers flee prosecution, only to end up in a country where they're not welcome. Just a note that we're not using Rose's real name here to protect her identity. Matt Katz is a reporter at WNYC and went to Japan to report on this story. Thank you for joining us, Matt.
Thank you, Arun.
Before we begin, Matt, let me just mention to our listeners that I did listen to some of the early drafts of your reporting as part of a listening session here at WNYC and made some suggestions on other parts of this series. To me, Matt, Japan is a really fascinating example of a country that has severely restricted immigration. And based on how some people responded to your series, it has a lot of symbolic value, not just to people in Japan, but to people here in the West, correct?
Yeah, I realize that there is a fascination, even a fetish for the perception that Japan is monoethnic. So white supremacists really love this idea of Japan as this society that has successfully been able to restrict immigration to stay, quote unquote, Japanese and still be part of the, you know, global community. So when I reported on the fact that there's such restrictions to immigration, and the white supremacists responded and said, leave Japan alone. Don't bring these globalist ideas into what is an otherwise perfect society.
So let's talk about one of the people who was displaced and sought refuge here in Japan, Rose.
She's an interesting case because very few people are aware of the conflict in Cameroon. It's one of these many flashpoints throughout the world that are creating refugees. Cameroon is going through what's basically a civil war right now between French speakers and English speakers. It is literally a conflict over language. Mm-hmm. The government is controlled by the Francophones, and Rose comes from the Anglophone region. And the English speakers have long said that the French-speaking government have not given them fair rights. So Rose's family was involved in a separatist movement in Cameroon to break away from this French-speaking controlled government. And she lost touch with that movement because she actually was sexually assaulted by soldiers who were looking for her father when she was a teenager. So she didn't want anything to do with politics. She moved away from her home village and she became a teacher. She came back home on a visit in 2016 and she joined a teacher protest. She says she just thought it was a protest to push for more resources for English-speaking schools. But teachers and lawyers have been at the tip of the spear of this separatist movement in Cameroon, and they're seen as anti the Cameroonian government. So this protest, the government came down quite hard on it. She starts to explain a little bit about that in an interview I did with her.
The military will come with their van and they're like, you get in, you get in, you get in, and let me have your phone, you give your phone. So there were times they would take us all and not everybody would come back. Like, I have two colleagues, till today we've not heard from them. It's more than a year. And in Cameroon, you could be awaiting trial for 3 or 4 years. And nobody's talking about you. Nobody's getting back to you. So that was when I noticed that maybe one day will be my turn not to come back.
And she needed to leave. That's what she decided. So she used all of her money. She borrowed a bunch of money and she hired a broker. This is what people throughout the world do when they need to leave their country. They hire somebody in the black market to figure out a way out of where they're at. And the broker came back to her with an unusual offer.
So he just called me and asked me that, what if I told you I got a visa for you for Japan? I said, I'll be happy. He said, yeah, I got a visa. That was on a Wednesday morning. And he told me I had to leave on Thursday morning.
So she has literally hours to pick up and move to another continent.
Right. And she really embodies the story of refugees today. They leave in a hurry, and there are conflicts all throughout the globe, people are just flying into Tokyo and declaring asylum. They're asking to stay, and they're doing it by the thousands. So Japan cannot stay this isolated island that it had been for centuries. She finds a guy at the airport who speaks English, and he takes her around to a bunch of hotels until she finds one that she could afford. She had $100 in her pocket. And then she calls this woman who's an acquaintance of an acquaintance who's from Cameroon, and she goes to her place in Japan, and she spends a couple of nights there. This woman tells her about a nonprofit called Japan Association for Refugees. She goes to this office. She says where she's from and what she needs, and she'd like to figure out how to declare asylum and get a job and stay in Japan. And they tell her there's no way she's going to win asylum in Japan.
I'm like, how is this possible? Why won't they believe that people are truly in danger? Why won't they believe that people are running for their lives?
But the people from the Japan Association for Refugees say, I'm sorry, but Japan doesn't take hardly any refugees. They took just 42 people last year. And many of them, when they declare asylum at the airport, just like what happens in the U.S., if you land at JFK or LAX and you declare asylum, you often get detained and you're held in detention until your hearings. And what's interesting is people who follow the asylum process in America will hear parallels. It's a similar sort of thing that's going on in this country now. It is increasingly difficult to find safety in the U.S. if you're claiming that you face persecution at home. And that same phenomena is happening all over the world, in Japan, in the U.S., and in Europe. All of these countries signed agreements after World War II with the U.N. saying that anybody who is facing persecution can find safety in these countries. But in reality, that's just not the way it's working anymore.
And so Rose is in this predicament. She enters into this landscape, and she's trying to navigate it. What happens to her?
So she was able to get subsidized housing through this nonprofit, and she takes Japanese lessons, and she submits her application for asylum. She lives a very meager lifestyle there. She has rice and nothing else most days of the week. And she tries to adjust to life in Japan, because the thing about asylum seekers is it takes months and even years in the U.S. or in Japan or elsewhere for your case to be reviewed, even if you know that you're going to end up getting deported at the end of it.
And so basically, this might be seen by some people who are critics of the Japanese system as a way simply of keeping out diversity. When you interact with people from Japan, how do they see people like Rose?
There's very little in the way of overt discrimination. You don't hear people saying disparaging things about immigrants. There's also very little civic conversation about immigration compared to what we hear in this country, in terms of it dominating television and news and public conversation. It's quieter restriction, restrictive approach. There's a understanding that Japan needs to attract foreigners, but there is concern that too many foreigners can echo the scenes people have seen on TV of Syrians entering Europe, of people in the Mediterranean Sea in boats, amassed on boats, trying to get into Greece, or the caravans coming from the southern border of the U.S. And Japanese are aware of those images, and there are concern that Japan could be overrun with these immigrants and asylum seekers. And then the most pragmatic of the Japanese tell me that they need the foreigners and that their country can't survive without bringing in these immigrants. But in the meantime, the stance of the Japanese government is more of a outsourcing approach. So they are Japan is a quite generous donor to the UN Refugee Agency, but that money is really to house and feed refugees in camps abroad rather than spending money to resettle them in Japan.
So what does life in Japan hold for Rose?
She's looking for work. She's allowed to work while she's applying for asylum. And then she's looking for community. She has made a friend, a Japanese friend who takes her around and introduces her to new food. But she spoke movingly to me about how loneliness is one of the many obstacles that refugees face. It's not just money. It's not just trying to learn the language and navigating the streets. It's this almost unbearing sense of loneliness. It's something that I think immigrants and asylum seekers and refugees the world over experience. And she tries to deal with that by, you know, talking to her son every day and calling family back home. But she doesn't know what will come of her situation. If she's there for 2 years and then is deported, if she's allowed to stay in Japan, will she be able to get a job? And will she be able to have the money to one day reunite with her son? As in many of my conversations with the refugees there and in the U.S., it comes down to family separation. Being apart from family and the way the conflict all over the world and restrictive borders all over the world have led to this family separation, almost an epidemic of family separation, is the prevailing emotional difficulty that these immigrants experience.
Matt Katz is a reporter at WNYC. Thanks for joining us, Matt.
Thank you, Arun.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.